The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Climate Matters. I'm Lindsay Wood, Director of Climate Strategy Company Resilience Limited, and Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Well, if you listened last week, you'll know that I decided to split Climate Matters 135 into two episodes because it was had a very quite a deep dive into an issue that one of our readers had raised against Climate Matters 134, and I would not have had time last week to cover that. So today we're going to go into that in some depth, and it is basically related to the report in Climate Matters 134 about how people all around the world want their government to do, governments, plural, to do more about their climate responses, and also some pretty interesting survey results about our own perception of our own willingness to act and that of other people. I received a substantial email from a professor in New Zealand, I'll call him Ralph, who challenged some of the conclusions that I had happily relayed from the Guardian newspaper's report on that. So I went down a big rabbit hole trying to unpick that, and this is a discussion of that rabbit hole. If you think that this is not an excursion that you're going to enjoy listening to, then you might want to be prepared to switch off. But hopefully you'll find it interesting enough. And I did go down some interesting angles, more of a rabbit warren than a rabbit hole. So let's get into it. Basically, to recap a little bit, in Climate Matters 134, it reported a huge study. We'll link again to it. It was reported at The Guardian. 130,000 people were surveyed in 125 countries. That's huge. And they found an average of 89% of people want governments to take more action on climate. That was over the whole world. B, that everywhere, every individual country, individuals thought that they were more worried about climate than their fellow citizens. That was a staggeringly uniform result across the whole world. And C, people in poorer countries were more willing to commit 1% of their income to climate action than people in wealthier countries. That's a fascinating and counterintuitive result, isn't it? I also can jog your memory a little bit, or try and jog it. We displayed a chart in the last Climate Matters that actually showed, it was a country by country, showing how many people in a particular country said they were willing to contribute 1% of their income to fighting climate change. And then also how many people in the same country, how many others they thought would be willing to contribute a dollar. And here's the interesting thing, is that every country without exception, people thought they themselves were more worried about climate than everybody else in the country. And this was consistent. For example, in Greece, around about 80% of people said they would put in one percent of their income to help fight climate change, whereas they thought also only about 49% of other people in Greece would do the same. The same could be said for Germany, for the UK, for Russia. The average across Europe was 65% were willing to put a 1% of their income to climate action, but they, on average, they only thought about 35% of other people would. Staggering. Interesting. The same goes for other parts of the world. New Zealand didn't come up in a very good light there. Only about 48% of Kiwis said they'd be prepared to spend 1% of their income. That was only slightly better than Russia, and it was slightly worse than the US. The other thing was that we were worse than Australia. Australia, I think, about 53 or 54% said they would be willing to spend 1%. and they thought about 47% of other people would. So interesting results. However, the piece prompted a detailed and courteous challenge from Ralph, as I mentioned. And here's a précis of what he said. He wrote to me and said, "I feel compelled to challenge one of the claims. Wouldn't it be the case that if the Guardian stats were true, this 89% wanting their governments to do more about climate, if that were true, wouldn't green parties be in charge in most countries, or at least be the dominant ruling party in some? In New Zealand, this party's vote, i.e. the Green Party, has remained between 5 and 15%. I would argue," this is Ralph still writing, "I would argue that what we are seeing is social desirability bias at play. In particular, respondents both want to please those asking the questions as well as not look bad in front of those conducting the interviews / surveys." He also referenced other surveys, including on British politics, and he noted that there was a lack of testing of the Guardian's reported findings against real-world situations. And he'd cited some himself of where surveys didn't match the real world. And then he then went on to note a further contradiction in the reporting was the lack of respondents factoring in the prospect of climate refugees. And in closing, in sum, he concluded, the Guardian article is guilty of portraying unfounded optimism. So what I've just quoted there is probably about a quarter of what Ralph wrote to me, maybe even less than a quarter. Obviously, coming from a senior academic, I took that seriously. I would also say that statistics is not a strong point of mine. I'm reasonably fluent at many aspects of maths, but I've never really gone into statistics, and I wouldn't claim to be able to put a good statistics lens over things like the report that The Guardian referenced. However, I do take my own due diligence seriously. I took Ralph's challenge as being well-founded. He's a respected academic, and he's obviously, he quoted some things that I thought made sense. Although I have to say, it didn't seem to me that, well, I didn't see the Green Party's success as being as obvious as he did. Certainly some people will vote Green, but it's not like climate is on everybody's radar, point one, or if it is, it's not like it is necessarily the dominant thing that will determine voting. For example, sometimes it's cost of living. If you were voting in Ukraine, you'd be very focused on military security and so on. So I don't see that as automatically that large number of people wanting the government to do more about it, meaning that it should translate necessarily into a dominant Green Party, even though I think, you know, there's some merit to that line of thought. And also stretch my credibility a bit that such a huge survey over so many countries by senior academics overseas didn't already have their sights on those statistical biases that Ralph referenced, and that it was a peer-reviewed paper and so on. So I thought that it would already have addressed the factors that he was concerned about. So anyway, I wrote to Damien Carrington, who is the environmental editor of The Guardian newspaper, and he was also the person that wrote the article that I was referencing. I also wrote to Professor Peter Andre, who was the lead author of the paper, and I outlined the concerns Ralph had raised with me to both of them. And then I pressed send on those two, and almost instantly, by pure coincidence, I received a Substack from Hannah Ritchie. And now some of you may know, I've quoted her before. She is the prime mover behind the well-known website Our World in Data, and she crunches all sorts of numbers, I'm sure, with the help of others, but she's the lead of it. And her latest Substack landed in my inbox just by chance then. It was actually on the generational divide on climate awareness. You know, are younger people a lot more worried than older people and so on? just as an aside, not as much as we might think. But the real point was that in that post of hers, she referenced an earlier post she'd done entitled "More People Care About Climate Change Than You Think." And I thought, bingo, that's exactly what I've just written to Damien Carrington and Peter Andre about. So, of course, I dived into Richie's article in Our World in Data. And very interesting. She also referenced that Andre report. So there's a sort of a circularity or closing a loop there. And she also referenced other reports, such as one that interviewed or surveyed 59,000 people in 63 countries, so on their belief in climate change. And out of interest, they found that 86% of them across the world or across the 63 countries did believe that climate change was real and that we should be doing stuff about it. So very interesting to get that sort of corroboration. Richie's post also included maps that was her way of expressing how the different countries were responding, both to the Peter Andre survey that I've been writing about and on the other survey, which was led by someone called Madalena Vlaskianu. And interesting enough, these were two world maps with colouring to show the strength of response on to the two different surveys. And the interesting thing for me was how much the two maps looked like each other. They weren't identical, but the places that were showed the most willingness to donate money to climate change were also the places that were most convinced that climate change was real and so on. So that was an interesting thing. So then anyway, while I was waiting for Damien Carrington and Peter Andre to get back to me, having emailed them and seen Hannah Ritchie's article, Ralph and I exchanged a couple of good-natured emails. I think he felt pretty bad that I'd gone to so much trouble, but I don't mind that at all. I think it's really valid to be challenged, and it wasn't like it was a flippant challenge. He had good reason for it, and I take my due diligence very seriously. So I went down the well, and also I went back into the main article I'd been reporting on, and to be truthful, I was impressed by their statistical explanations and the supplementary data they supplied, impressed with the qualification that I'm statistically naive, so I'm not really well placed to judge whether they're doing the right things. But for example, I quoted in the last Climate Matters, here's a little bit. Both results, this is quoting from the paper, both results replicate in a joint multivariate regression and are robust to the inclusion of continent fixed effects and other economic, political, cultural, or geographic factors. Now, I can't really unpick that for you. I'll leave it to you to unpick it if you want, but I read that as being one of many instances where they explained the statistical approach and the cross-checking and the harmonization of their results. Anyway, to my great surprise and pleasure, I very quickly got replies from both Damien Carrington and Peter Andre. Carrington wrote briefly, I hadn't asked for an in-depth response, and he wrote, and I'm quoting the core of his email, "The research I based the article on was done by respected academics who are, of course, aware of social desirability bias." That was the one that my correspondent challenged, and going back to Carrington, "and take steps to limit this bias. I think the global consistency of the results and the huge margins in favour indicate real beliefs. I think voting green is a very blunt measure." So that was Damien Carrington's response. Peter Andre wrote more fully, even though he was on vacation at the time. And here are some extracts from his that I think are relevant. So I'm quoting, "The social desirability effect is always a potentially relevant methodological concern in survey research. The desirability effect would need to be immense to overturn the qualitative conclusions of our study. Many other studies come to the same conclusion, he said, and then he carries on. Here's a non-technical summary by Our World in Data. Now, that's pointing to the same piece that by Hannah Ritchie that I just referenced. Desirability effects are not only survey artifacts, Andre comments, they operate in the real world too. So what he's saying is that, you know, you have to do a much wider thing than perhaps my commentator Ralph was suggesting. Peter Andre goes on to say, the pessimistic conclusion from the observation, that's by Ralph, that voters often don't vote green and consumers often don't consume green, is that voters and consumers don't care. I'll read that again because it's important. The pessimistic conclusion from the observation that voters often don't vote green and consumers often don't consume green is that voters and consumers don't care. This conclusion is exactly the type of inference that sustains pluralistic ignorance, but it is premature and not in line with the data. Voters and consumers do care. So that's a very important final sentence by Peter Andre. Voters and consumers do care. I was persuaded by these responses, and especially as they, purely by coincidence, were corroborated by Hannah Ritchie's article. I shared the correspondence with Ralph, and he really appreciated my efforts, but he also felt there were still a couple of statistical questions that had remained unanswered. However, we both agreed that we'd gone far enough down the rabbit hole to not be worth pursuing further. However, before I sign off, I want to make a comment here, because another point that Ralph made that I don't think I just mentioned is that there wasn't enough recognition of the impact of climate refugees or not enough public awareness of that. I was disinclined to agree with him there. I thought there was not a high level of awareness. Out of interest, and you may have heard this just last week, the Australian government made world history by being the first government to grant what they called climate visas, in this case to the island people of Tuvalu in the Pacific. The first agreement of its kind anywhere in the world, the Aussie government announced, providing a pathway for mobility with dignity as climate impacts worsen. Well done, the Aussies, on that. And I found it particularly lovely to read the word dignity in there. And I've finished by saying, is that a word that's still in the New Zealand Parliament's lexicon? Because it doesn't come across at all that way with this present government. However, a final note is that the question of climate refugees reminded me of a very touching little YouTube clip that I came across a few years ago. In fact, shared it with readers in Climate Matters 48 in 2020, and I've put a link to it again. And it is a six-minute video. It's by a woman who was then a college student, Fili Fepaloa'i'i, and she's a Samoan. And it deserves our full attention. There will be a link to that on the Fresh FM website. I think it's a touching and well worth our attention. So on that note, I'm going to finish off here. That's Lindsay Wood signing off and thanking you again for your company. I hope you haven't found this too much of a rabbit hole. Actually, wait on, I've missed something. Sorry, I was going to give you another item from the Can You Believe It files that I didn't include last time. Just let me find it. I found this remarkable. Where is it? Sorry, you'll just have to bear with me. I'm scrolling up. More from the Can You Believe It files. Is the Arctic becoming more electric? The Arctic basically didn't have lightning at all, is a quote from atmospheric scientist Robert Holdsworth, and he was being reported in an article in Yale Environment 360. But now the Arctic has thousands of strikes a year, and one was recently reported just 50 millimeters from the North Pole, which is a record and was unimaginable until very recently. So the reasons, of course, are very complicated for this, but they center on two main things. One is the increased precipitation, and another one is the increased air instability. And both of those are functions of global overheating. So if you factor more lightning into areas that now have less snow cover and warmer temperatures and more thawing tundra, more lightning can also mean more wildfires. And that feels like another of those vicious cycles that we'd very much like to avoid. So, sorry, I didn't remember to put that in before, but it's another disturbing point of interest. So going back, thank you for your company for this week. I hope the rabbit hole I dived down wasn't too labyrinthine for you. Of course, you're listening to Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Fresh FM broadcasts in Blenheim on 88.9, to Eastern Golden Bay on 95.0, to the Nelson CBD on 107.2, and across the Nelson Tasman region on 104.8. It's also streamed to the planet on freshfm.co.nz, and podcasts of Climate Matters and of other locally produced shows are available through freshfm.co.nz and through the accessmedia.nz app. So on that note, I'm going to really finish this time. Thanks again for your company, and of course, kia kaha for the climate.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.